and welcome to Fishy Business, a series dedicated to exploring the lesser-known side of cybersecurity. I'm Alice.
And I'm Brian, and we're colleagues of Mimecast. Every episode, we'll be joined by a special visitor, or in this case, visitors, who are definitely not your average guests, to share tales of risk, reward, and ridiculousness.
We'll be looking for new ways to think about cybersecurity, to learn how we can all improve in the fight to stay safe.
This week, Alice, I've been reading about carbon spider, mythic leopard, and even ocean buffalo.
Those sound like some pretty colourful characters, but I'm guessing that sadly they're not from children's picture books, I can imagine.
Unfortunately not, you're correct. These are all code names for some of the biggest cyber attacks of 2020, created by threat intelligence experts tracking their activities.
So to help us shed some light on this, we have threat intelligence experts Derek Buchanan from CrowdStrike and our very own Director of Threat Intelligence, Francis Gaffney, to talk us through not only how threat intelligence works, but also the latest cybercrime trends and how businesses can protect against them. Hi both, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
So threat intelligence certainly sounds like a glamorous and maybe slightly dangerous job. Derek, how would you explain to somebody what you do at a pub or a bar?
Before or after they've had a drink? I think it's more along the lines of you protect the company against what is deemed as the threats that we see from actors who want to cause a company harm. I think that's kind of one of the best ways to summarize it than anything else.
And Francis, I've definitely seen you on a Zoom call or two over the last year or so. Which makes sense as your Director of Threat Intelligence here at Mimecast. How would you explain your job over a drink?
I think mine is really trying to predict tomorrow's news for today. So telling tomorrow's news today.
Fair enough.
And so, Derek, tell us, how did you get into threat intelligence in the first place? I can imagine we have some listeners who are looking to come into this space. Would you be able to share some of your story with us?
Yeah, sure. Well, definitely. I think, I happened to kind of fall into it through my time at law enforcement. I kind of enjoyed it. It was something that kind of grasped me at the first start. The whole idea of being able to look and piece together different puzzles, but every time be able to layer it with something new and then explore why that was new, which was the curiosity. And kind of then be able to then try and bring it to some sort of fruition. So see it actually come to life. And to see people actually operating and actually realizing, responding to what you're saying based on this information that you're collecting from so many wide variety of sources was something that I kind of do and I kind of love, really. It's a great job.
And Francis, how did you get into threat intelligence?
I think, again, a similar way for Derek, and that not you fell into it, but it was a following a pathway of sorts. So I started off in something called influence operations, which is where we try and influence a target to do something we want it to, and then moved into counterterrorism in terms of the academic world. So I would look at, you know, as an academic looking at the impacts of, in my case, before and after September 11th. And then in the academic world, we were looking at how one would study the methodologies of how terrorist organizations form, grow, you know, then start committing, the violent activities or terrorist activity. And we apply those same things to cyber. So then moving across, you have an unknown actor with certain TTPs, certain methodologies. How does one then start identifying who they are, how they work, and, you know, why they work? So it was a natural progression from counterterrorism into cyber.
Okay, that sounds really interesting. And what was the proudest moment of your career?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think. It would be, you know, I reported to it sometimes to the Prime Minister. So when you actually then get that FaceTime with the Prime Minister and you go home and see something you've said on Sky News. So, yeah.
I think echoing kind of the transition what Francis says, I think it's being able to work on some of the most high-profile investigations that in an ordinary capacity you wouldn't be able to. And being a part of that essentially is kind of one of the moments that kind of takes you away. It's a differentiator in that sort of sense. And it kind of brings a little bit of a fire when you kind of talk about these things, because they are kind of like a proud moment where you can see that you've achieved quite a lot just in that small space of time on those operations that you worked on historically.
Oh, that's fascinating. And we can't wait to dig into that a little bit deeper going forward. But I guess kind of taking a little bit of a step back, and Francis, from your experiences, you know, you're our Director of Threat Intelligence at Mimecast. How would you explain in simple terms how threat intelligence works, and what does your team do and look for?
So, yeah, I think if we do the reverse way around, if I look at what my team does, and that hopefully will explain to you how we then work. So I have four disciplines in our team. So we have the data scientists. They're the real technical brains. They're the ones who go off and find the data, exploit the data. And then we have our threat intelligence analysts. So the TI analysts, they will actually then use structured analytical techniques. And this is where my results are reproducible. So instead of, you know, one could say, well, are we going to recover from COVID-19 economically? A lot of people in the room should be able to say yes. And an analyst, an intelligence analyst, should actually be able to say yes and then give a sort of confidence level, give a value, give a when, give a how. So it's a slight difference to people being able to, from experience, say yes or no. We actually use these techniques to be able to give a value to it and quantify what we're saying. So that's what the analysts do. And then we have the strategic intelligence analysts. And what they do is effectively look ahead to 6 months to 2 years and start saying, well, actually, this is what we think the threat landscape will look like in that time. And this is important to customers. And Derek had said about this earlier in his, you know, what he does. What we're trying to do is say to our customers, look, this is what we think is going to happen. And therefore, they may be able to invest or become, you know, harden themselves as a target. So they're, you know, more resilient to these attacks. And then the last section is that risk and resilience. So that's where we have our e-crime expert, and also how we can mitigate risk, but also give our customers a value of the risk. So we would say, here's a threat, this is the associated risk, and then it's up to their risk appetite, their budgets, whether they accept that risk or not. So they're the four areas. And then, as I say, that intelligence we do, it has to be predictive. And in the definition of intelligence, it's predictive. So if I'm saying to you, here's some IOCs, you know, indicators compromise, and this is, you know, how it happened, that to me is news. The damage is already done. What I want to know is, how do I stop that? So it is the difference between news and weather. And I've used this analogy over the last 2 years of being at Mimecast, but I want to know whether I need an umbrella tomorrow. I didn't need to be told, oh, by the way, you needed one today. I noticed that, I got wet. What I want to know is, I need an umbrella tomorrow. So really, it has to be predictive. And I do hear it thousands of times saying, yes, we use predictive intelligence. Predictive. So it is that intelligence has to be predictive by its very means. It has to be timely. There's no point in me saying to you, by the way, there's a threat. You're like, yeah, I know, I've already got it. And also it has to be actionable. If I'm telling you something that you can't do anything about, that doesn't help you, it just frustrates you. So it has to be timely, accurate, and actionable and predictive.
And Derek, CrowdStrike's just launched, in France's terms, kind of the equivalent of reporting on the weather for last year, the 2021 Global Threat Report, talking about what's happened in 2020. And we've mentioned some of the titles given to the attacks and attackers, which have included names like Charming Kitten and Wizard Spider. How do you end up with names like this?
I mean, I used to kind of like wonder that myself, and you kind of hear about all these different names and the ways and the variations there. But it's a really simple process, really. You know, you think that each one of these actors, they have two names, and first and the last. And the last makes up the reference in terms of the type of actor, and the first, their speciality. So when you think about the likes of Wizard Spider, Wizard Spider is one of the creators of TrickBot. So wizards do trick. So essentially, he's a spider. And essentially, the spider essentially makes up the type of crimes that they actually engage in. So, for example, the spiders are all very much e-crime, financially motivated adversaries. And that's what makes them that. So that ability to be able to be named as such. I mean, there are other names that we have, such as, you know, there for the Hail Russia, the adversaries that hail from that particular region. We call pandas, you know, the likes of, they're hailing from China, Chalinas from North Korea, and jackals and hacktivists from hacktivists and kittens from Iran. So it's kind of a variation. They're kind of quirky names, but it provides that humorality and attribution to it.
And Derek, without giving too much away, would you be able to give us a bit of an insight into maybe some of the key findings or the trends that were found in the report?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the state-sponsored adversaries are something that has always been pivotal, especially within the CrowdStrike element. And it's no current surprise that they've leveraged the likes of to trying to target organizations in order for the development of vaccine. and also look at government responses in relation to the types of activity that's happened and surrounded the pandemic. The signification is also mentioned throughout the report in relation to big game hunting and ransomware activities, and how that has kind of evolved from the springboard of big game hunting into the extortion techniques and blackmail. E-crime and the way in which it's evolved and become very polymorphic with these adversaries now, and the development and new variants of malware and techniques, and the way in which they try to skirt and circumvent detection is something they're purposely out to do and try to confound and try to confuse defenders from all types. The landscape in itself has changed, you know, in a way that the pandemic has kind of allowed it to change, essentially. It's opened it up to not just these circumnown adversaries that we fit into these boxes, but it's also brought about a new unattributed adversary, the one that you kind of didn't really expect to come out. And so you can think about when in the report they mentioned around at least 4 to 5 of these e-crime adversaries taking up most of the time. It's an increase to 70 to 80%, I think. That's 10% higher than last year. So, you know, it's still continuing. And the likes of the nation state adversaries still have their own objectives and interests from a long-standing view.
And I think on that note, actually, you both raise a really interesting point there. You know, Derek, I guess we'll start with you first. From the CrowdStrike report, have you found in your experience differences or big changes in behavior and patterns over, say, the last year in comparison to previous years because of, let's say, the pandemic and COVID coming into play?
I mean, the pandemic, as I said to you before, it's essentially a threat actor's playground. That's probably the best way to describe it. It's given them a landscape and a springboard to be able to, not an excuse, because the threat actors do follow the geopolitical trends and they follow the landscape in whichever way it goes. But it's allowed them to adopt more of a targeted mantra because the fact that we've had to revolve around the particular pandemic itself. The things that they've done is, some of it has been very, very basic. So the decoy themes that they've done for different types of pharmaceuticals companies, the phishing domains, the different types of intrusions based on research for the nation state perspective, the different types of targeting of government or targeting of healthcare, although some of them have stated that they wouldn't target healthcare, but you know, it's not, you know, a trust to threat actor essentially. The research facilities, you know, they wouldn't target healthcare, but there's obviously their research entities around that. So the academia areas, things like that, that springboard, that's something which has kind of sprung up a bit more. And even though the likes of the indictments, which have kind of followed, and the robust law enforcement actions that have kind of dampened down a lot of the activity, but threat actors are very active, and the way in which they've kind of adjusted that change of shift to move across. And for example, one of those change of shift which is observed is Wizard Spider. Wizard Spider is a very, very aggressive type of adversary, and the way in which they've moved from when the Imatep activity got taken down, they shifted to Smokebot and then essentially continued this activity from there. So they will shift. And like the likes of big game hunting, that's continued. You know, that will always have an element, but the twofold ransomware trend is something which is just continued to flourish throughout.
It seems as though a lot of these techniques have been around for a while, but they really just seem to have been exacerbated in the last year. I mean, we've seen, you've mentioned things like extortion being combined with ransomware. That's not a new thing, but there definitely seems to have been a real doubling down of that. We also seem to have seen things like multi-vector attacks. They've been around for a while, but they seem to be in sort of much higher use. Would you agree with that statement, that things seem to have got a lot more intense over the last 12 or so months?
So the multi-vector attack essentially is something which is always going to be continued in the way in which they deliver it. But when they sort of twist away a little bit more from that, and the themes that we see from all the different areas that they are the commonality ones, but they are becoming a little bit more sophisticated in the way that they want to utilize the likes of living off the land techniques. So these techniques are very, very much the idea to skirt under the radar, avoid detection, and use a lot of the open source type tools that they want to be able to leverage that are automatically commodity. So they won't just leverage just one technique and do that, but they'll also come in and have shared alliances and shared proxies. And that way, essentially, to be able to do the attacks from a multi-vector stage or even layer in by being able to have a service that they pick up from somewhere else or access that they've picked up from another organization, from another actor themselves, allows them to come in from so many different pivot points.
Francis, would you agree with that? Are we seeing something similar?
Most definitely, most definitely. So you have the sort of two types of threat actors we see. Ones that are those opportunistic who maybe respond to geopolitical tensions, things that are in the news, or just dates in a calendar. The numbers, I mean, we had 933 million odd detections last year, malware detections, and that's now 1.45 billion year on year. So, you know, we had a huge increase in just the detections.
And with kind of those increase in attacks that we have been seeing, what would you say are some of the key, say, top two things that you would suggest to organizations to help protect themselves against these and these ever-increasing threats?
So ransomware, it's a tried and trusted. So you're seeing this, and exactly what Derek has said. Emotet was a brilliant dropper to introduce the ransomware malware. Because it's a technique that works, they're going to use it until eventually it no longer works. So ransomware will continue while people still pay for data. And data at the moment is massively commoditized because we need our data, especially with the remote working. It's very, very important for us to have access to that data. So, and the threat actors know this. Therefore, they know it has value. And then the other one that was unusual this year, I would say, was attacks against healthcare. Because again, that interest, and again, as Derek says, it wasn't just necessarily people, making the vaccine or researching the vaccine. It was the whole supply chain. You had people who may have been legal or accountants companies, because you target them and then move across or move laterally into your ultimate target. So it was just healthcare, but associated industries, those professional services. So it was a very interesting observation watching that growth compared to previous years. So ransomware definitely, and I think those generally thematically will be healthcare.
And Derek, we often think of cybercrime as something that's perpetrated by actors or groups of people sitting in a dark basement or even a call center. But when what's actually there is a hugely sophisticated ecosystem, and I quite like the way that CrowdStrike kind of categorizes these ecosystems. They break them up into sort of three categories: services, distribution, and monetization. I've seen in the past. Could you maybe take us through some of that and explain the ways in which these threat actors actually have their own supply chain? They don't necessarily do everything, as Francis mentioned. Could you maybe break that down for us, just without going into a huge amount of detail as to what each of these different categories kind of looks like and how sophisticated some of these ecosystems can actually become?
No, sure. I mean, these as you said before, they're very much interlinked, and they're a complex network, but the way in which they work is very much in tandem with the shared relationships, the proxies, the alliances that they have. You can think about the services that they essentially have. Each particular threat actor operating their own services. You think about the likes of Avidon ransomware as a service model. It's a business model that they've based it on, which allows them then to essentially pivot them, point the way. It's like a market. It's like any type of business. They have their own marketing. They have their own blogs. So they go about their own chatter. They engage in conversations. And essentially, they advertise. So all of those things, they go about in that type of way. But they also have the alliances and the ability to show that they're in interconnection. They then talk to each other and have that conversion in the way that they're able to share tools, share techniques, things that they have leveraged across the time. And so it makes it that ability for us to be able to have that intelligence across the board that allows us then to protect customers in the way that we can and publish the type of data that we see in the report today. And it's that connection that makes all those connections that brings it together and that interlink, which kind of finalizes and puts the pieces together.
And I think that brings an interesting question into play. One of the reasons that, one of the whys as to why they do it would be because people pay them. And one of the reasons that people pay is because of cyber insurance. It's covered by cyber insurance. Derek, I'd be interested in your views on, the debate about cyber insurance. There's some jurisdictions that have actually argued that possibly cyber insurance should be outlawed because of the fact that people, first of all, assume they can have slightly lower cybersecurity standards and because they're not that worried about having to pay a ransom because that then gets covered by the insurance. What are your views on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting topic. It's not something which is rose's head too much, but it's kind of skirted out at a level, but it's been mentioned along the lines. And so, I mean, you think of cyber insurance as something that's there to cover you, and you think about security, you think about liability and protection of all your particular assets. But there's also a lot of other things that go in kind of tandem with that. The business, the interruption, the loss of revenue, the activity that's taken place, especially towards a business. And also the fact that the coverage in terms of whether the actual company is kind of either left information out there that suggests that they have this insurance. And so it makes an attractive prospect when an adversary is conducting their reconnaissance around a particular organization. They'll start to leverage that. And that's one of the things that's been mentioned, not just across the board, that actors do look upon that as a way to try and to leverage the company. They will say that they have the insurance. But the thing is that does the insurance cover the whole aspect of the ransom, especially if the threat actor knows that they have that? So again, it's just being kind of conscious of the way in which some of the actors, some of the way that we have this insurance, and just keeping it to a level in terms of not being able to disclose too much around those areas.
And I know from our State of Email Security report, we saw a rise in ransomware in the last 12 months, where more than 6 out of 10 respondents experienced a ransomware attack, for example, and potentially more worryingly, 52% of respondents actually paid the ransom. Potentially they had cyber insurance in the back end there. But Francis, what do you make of that figure? What can organizations do to stop themselves from being forced to pay cyber criminals?
That figure, I would suggest, is higher. I know this is what people would say, but would they admit to the fact that they actually have been? Because as Derek says, sometimes it may make you an attractive target again, because you've already paid a ransom once. Who's to say you'd pay it again? You know, so, and the cyber insurance, I think, is an issue that's going to grow and grow. Because if I left the keys to my Range Rover next to it on the pavement, I don't have a Range Rover. But anyway, if I left them the keys to the pavement, well, my insurance company would say, well, sorry, you're an unfaithful servant in a way. You left your keys there. We're not going to pay out. So if you've got a low-quality cybersecurity vendor, so you've got the bare minimum you needed to keep yourself safe, well, then actually me as a stakeholder, you hold my data, I'll be saying, well, wait a minute, I've given you my data. I'm entitled for that data to be kept, you know, the CIA triad, you know, confidential, you know, safe and not able to be exploited. You haven't put in cybersecurity layers of defense in place that's sufficient to protect my data. I should have some sort of comeback.
I think heightened visibility is one of the first and pivotal things to look about, especially around their own networks and especially around their own endpoints. It's kind of pivotal, the visibility piece, and knowing their own infrastructure, backing up their data and making the backups actually safe. That's something which is quite pivotal. I think investing in a threat intelligence capability, being a bit biased there, but I think it's one of the things that is always going to provide that overarching blanket that you need from a strategic and operation and a tactical level. It's about giving you the front foot forward, and context is always king. You know, the alarm going off in your car, but so your neighbor's pointing and saying this is the person who did it, is always going to derive context and something that it always needs to apply there, especially if you're getting threats within your own environment.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, Francis and Derek. I mean, this conversation is one that I really enjoy, and I wish we had a lot more time to go through it. We always like to end our episodes by asking our guests 3 simple questions.
So looking back over your career, Derek, what would you say is one insight that you'd wish you'd learned sooner, or that you could go back and tell your younger self, for example?
I think probably did this job a little bit earlier. I think maybe learn a bit more, become a little bit more technical as well.
And what about you, Francis?
I think I would always like to have learned a language, Russian or Chinese. You know, I actually would have liked to have got into this trade a lot earlier. I think going through the other 2 trades before I got here, it was a long slog to get to here. I could have just bypassed it all and, you know, started looking at cyber earlier.
So to all of our cyber threat intelligence analysts for the future, there's your advice to try and start now.
Don't wait, get on with it. I'll give you Derek's email address so you can send your CVs to him.
And I think we can often tell a lot about our guests by what they have on their nightstand or their bedside table. So, Francis, what are you reading or listening to at the moment? And is there anything that you'd recommend for our listeners?
The book I'm reading at the moment is The Hobbit, to my own little Hobbit. So, unfortunately, yes, it's not necessarily highbrow, I'm afraid. And with their attention span, we're also reading Harry Potter, Goblet of Fire. So they're my two books I'm going to. We just swap chapters. And so, nothing highbrow. Could I recommend it? They're both very, very good books. J.K. Rowling's a great author, and so too is Tolkien. I can't recommend them enough. Sorry, not highbrow.
And Derek, do you go more highbrow than that, than The Hobbit and Harry Potter?
Yeah, I mean, I think I may go a little bit and go on top of what Francis has got there. And I've got one which is reading to my son now, which is Bad Dad. So this is David Williams' book. It's fantastic, actually. I didn't realise that I'd actually enjoy it, but I actually feel like I'm missing out on bedtime reading now.
So anyone on this podcast is now judging us too. Yeah, you've got Bad Dad, I've got The Hobbit. Well, this was listening.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's a real book, and other than that, it's the only other real book that I'm probably reading is Measuring and Managing Risk. It's all about risk models and various frameworks, and it's by Jack Jones and Jack Freud, which is a really, really good book. It talks about all the types of risk frameworks and FAIR frameworks. So it's quite an in-depth book, definitely a bedtime reader, that's for sure.
And now, looking a bit more to the future, Derek, this time next year, what would your prediction be for how the threat landscape will look?
I think, obviously, ransomware is all going to be a pivotal flow. It's always going to continue and still going to be an emerging trend. Access brokers is going to be quite pivotal. The ability for threat actors to quickly get access to networks quite fast, that's something that flow. The cyber insurance blacks is always going to be something which, again, it's going to be pivotal, but also the third party supplier chain. Again, I think a lot of organizations are going to be quite cognizant of that and wary of that a lot more.
And Francis, in an ideal world, would you like to see organizations around the world taking Derek's earlier advice and increasing their cybersecurity in the kinds of ways that he mentioned?
I think they're going to have to. I would like them to. I actually think they will. Because people have been remote working, they've actually understood the value of having a good cybersecurity provision or good cybersecurity hygiene. I think we're not now going to go back. Not saying back to the office, but yeah, you know, people have understood how important data is. They've understood that how much of their life is actually in the online, the virtual space, and therefore, not saying they're scared, but I think they would actually be more cognizant of who's got their data and who's doing what with their data.
So thank you so much to you both for joining us today and sharing your valuable insights. I can imagine our listeners will definitely want to hear more, learn more. So where would be the best place for them to find out more information about some of the topics that we found today? Derek, if we start with you.
A lot of the things that we've spoken about today are on the CrowdStrike website. So you can go to CrowdStrike, go to resources, go to reports, and you can pull all of our reports from there, straightforward.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Francis, from a Mimecast reporting perspective, where would be the best place for our listeners to find our latest information?
So our stuff is actually on the Mimecast Threat Intelligence Hub. We have the hub there for not just customers, all stakeholders. You know, I do actually recommend CrowdStrike's reporting because, again, it's something we use in our assessments. So, yeah, the Mimecast Threat Intelligence Hub.
Fantastic. So Derek, Francis, thank you both so much for your time today. I think we may need to have a follow-up podcast because there's still loads of questions that we have to ask you, but unfortunately we don't have enough time today, but definitely for the future. And thank you so much to all of our listeners for joining us on this week's Fishy Business. It's been an absolute pleasure having you with us. If you've enjoyed our podcast, please do leave us a review on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you're hearing this. And feel free, of course, to follow us on Twitter page @Mimecast if you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today. Thanks all.